Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
I'm Dr. Angela Coombs.
And I'm Dr. Jen Sotsky. You're listening to Psych Pearls, a collaboration between Psychiatric Times and the Columbia University Department of Psychiatry.
We are two early career psychiatrists grappling with the most pressing issues in mental health today, both inside and outside of the office, with the help of our guest experts. Today, we are grateful to host part two of a special two-part series on the impact of COVID on physicians and the patients they serve.
We're honored to have our guests, Dr. Nyesha Voigt and Dr. Casey Grew. Dr. Voigt is a third-year psychiatry resident physician at Columbia who was redeployed to work on medical ICU services during the COVID-19 surge here in New York last spring, and Dr. Grew is a former anesthesia chief resident at Columbia and current critical care fellow at UCLA who worked in ICUs through COVID surges on both coasts. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, sure, there's a lot to say about your experiences with COVID, but we were hoping to start with kind of what was your experience like during the first surge and how does that compare to now when we're more than a year out?
You want to go first, Aisha?
Sure. I guess the first thing I remember is just the massive amount of uncertainty and how things change so quickly. We were first, as psychiatry residents, told to be on standby and that we may see some changes in our clinical services. And then all of a sudden, it became very clear that there was a lot of need and that we were all going to be asked to be doing very different jobs within the hospital, whether that be within our own clinical services or even being redeployed back to the medical services. I found myself 1 week doing psychiatry consults and the next week on an IC unit with providers from many different specialties and at different stages of their careers. And we were all working with COVID patients. It all happened so fast. And the first time around, it was really tough to really experience the loss of some of our patients, but then also work with a lot of our colleagues who were experiencing loss of their family members, my own loss of some family members, and then continuing to really be devoted to helping our city and helping our hospital and our community. So that first surge was really difficult and felt like whiplash. Now I'm confronting COVID in a very different way. I primarily work in the outpatient psychiatric resident clinic and in the psychiatric emergency room. And with my outpatients, I find myself discussing the various stressors that they're experiencing and how COVID has affected their lives, whether that be through loss of a loved one, the trauma of their own illness, or even the anxiety of constantly having to change their understanding of how safe the world is around them. Much like the first surge, there's a lot of uncertainty, but this is a much slower approach to kind of our understanding of how our lives have changed. And at this point, there's a lot more hope in terms of how we're going to come out and how we're going to be able to continue to deal with this. It no longer seems like a moment in time, but a real change in the way in which we see the world.
So for me, as like a senior anesthesia resident at Columbia, my experience really started with the increasing number of stat intubations. So a senior anesthesia resident holds the airway pager. This pager usually goes off, you know, two or three times a day. And it started to go off, you know, five times a day. 10 times a day, you'd have to go intubate a COVID patient. I think at the peak, it went off like 17 times in one day. And one of my co-residents responded to yet another intubation. This was the day the pager went off 17 times. And the patient that she was intubating was one of our attendings. It's hard to convey the fear and the rapidity with which it felt that the situation was going out of control. I mean, I think we all felt like this is the apocalypse. And there was no respite. You know, we would do this all day and then we would go home. You know, I remember going home to my apartment on the Upper West Side and you'd hear an ambulance go by every 10 minutes. And you just thought about what your day one is going to be like tomorrow when you showed up at work. And I think the major difference, aside from obviously the scope and how quickly it happened and how unprepared we were, was watching how senior leadership was also really in over their head when this happened in New York. I think there's a unique fear that comes with watching your leaders really kind of scrambling and afraid. And it was clear that they didn't always know what to do either. Whereas I think now, you know, obviously the rate and the scope is not quite as high. Even when it was bad in LA, it felt like there was a system in place and the senior leadership always had a plan. And it just never felt like it was something that was totally out of our control.
Yeah, you know, it really is striking as you talk about watching your leaders scramble and, you know, the unique challenge of being a trainee. You know, in our part one, we spoke with two senior attendings, and we want to know, for as trainees who, you know, Housetop are the backbone of the hospital. You guys provide so much care to the patients that are served by Columbia's community, and the same goes across the country for academic institutions. What do you feel like were some of the unique challenges that you faced that were distinct from some of the attending physicians?
I'm going to have to echo what Casey really described, is that part of my residency experience, particularly my first year as a psychiatry resident, was constantly being placed and in new clinical services and different on different floors, whether that be a medicine floor, an ICU, an emergency room. But you were always guided by providers with significant experience in what we were treating. With COVID, it was new to everyone. And that was really tough, because part of what makes training very, or I guess what makes it not as scary, is that you know that you have someone to fall back on, or someone that's more senior that knows more about what you're dealing with, whether that be the disease, the patient population, the patient experience, and that could help guide you. In this situation, I remember being in the COVID ICU with pediatricians, with cardiologists, with critical care specialists, and we would discuss all of the different aspects of the care of each patient. And it was so clear that each week it changed based off of more information that we got from the literature as people across the world were treating this illness. And every day you're speaking to family members who are not able to come in and see their loved ones and communicating what's going on. And it feels very different to kind of be in that place as a trainee, to know that not only do you not necessarily understand the scope of what's going on, but not everyone around you knows either, because this is such a new experience. And this was a new illness that we were all being exposed to at the same time. So that uncertainty was extremely scary. And particularly as someone that was in a clinical service, that's not, you know, not my specialty, I felt it was extremely important to be really vigilant about every value, about every conversation, about every, all the guidance that I got, to make sure that I was doing right by all of the patients that I was caring for. And that can be really hard when it's a new illness and in this pandemic.
So just a little bit about how the anesthesia residents were utilized during this. Obviously we were running around intubating people, but you know, quickly it became apparent that elective surgery was not something that the hospital could spend its resources on. So the vast majority of the operating rooms were closed for surgery, and we had actually 3 or 4 COVID patients in every OR on the anesthesia machine ventilators. So we had 80 patients in this makeshift ICU, we called it the OR ICU, that was essentially run by the anesthesia department, mostly staffed by anesthesia residents. And I think for me, the main challenge of this was that anesthesiologists, for the most part, are very competent at critical care. We're very familiar with resuscitation, ventilator management. But an anesthesiologist is still not an intensivist. And so much of the skills that are specific to critical care, like navigating end-of-life decision-making, for example, are skills that a lot of anesthesiologists are just not that practiced at. So, you know, as a senior resident, I was responsible for, you know, three or four junior anesthesia residents who are sort of acting like interns, you know, putting in orders, writing notes, examining patients, that kind of thing. And we were giving them guidance. And then we also had an anesthesia attending, helping, you know, decide on bigger management decisions. But, you know, again, there's a lot of variability in how much these anesthesia attendings were familiar with or felt comfortable engaging in conversations with family about prognosis, goals of care, things like that. And I felt that as a trainee, I was actually closer to these skills, and I was often put into that role. And it's really, really challenging as a trainee navigating these decisions with family, sort of on your own, because, you know, I had several conversations with family members and ultimately guided them to withdraw care on their loved one. And I sort of did this with like really very little guidance and really no one to debrief those conversations or those decisions with. So not only did I guide the family to these decisions, which I, you know, I, to the best of my knowledge, were appropriate, but, you know, I'm an anesthesia resident. I'm not a, you know, board certified intensivist, obviously. And so then not only was I guiding the families through these decisions, I was actually then physically going into the room, turning off all the machines, taking out the breathing tube. You know, so I, in the end, felt like I was really unilaterally ending people's lives. And it was sort of, you know, it was challenging to feel that I was not entirely supported in that role.
I want to really talk about another unique challenge as a trainee that Casey started to touch on in terms of part of what supports you throughout training as a physician is the camaraderie that you have with your co-residents, the senior residents, and whether that be during lectures where you're all in the room or resident meeting, or even in the workroom at the end of the day, writing your notes. And part of what happened in the hospital during COVID is that we all had to separate ourselves from each other to keep each other safe. So we couldn't sit in a room next to each other at the end of the day, writing our notes and debrief the difficult experiences that we had, or the things that made us scared, or even share part of our lives that really helps. That really helps in what, you know, prevents burnout as a physician, and or helps kind of buffer the long hours that you spend in the hospital. And so, not being able to be near my co-residents, and particularly the co-residents that weren't on the same rotations, and all of us being so spread out in different parts of the hospital, was very difficult. And even in this past year, because we're having our, as psychiatry residents, we have our process group, but it's still remote, even though we're transitioning to in-person. And similarly with some of our lectures are all remote, and that camaraderie has been really difficult, or the loss of that camaraderie has been very difficult.
If you look back, knowing now what you know and what you experienced, what would you have wanted to have that you didn't have available to you at that time?
I think for me, you know, anesthesiologists are not psychiatrists, and we definitely had a collective awareness that we were experiencing something traumatic, but we definitely did not have formal spaces to process that, which I'm sure we would have benefited from. I actually had a different experience. I felt actually very close to my co-residents at this time. And maybe because we were all working in the same ICU together. And I still feel like the bonds I have with the people that I experience these things with will persist for a lifetime. I mean, because no one else can possibly understand what we saw. I think the main thing that was really challenging for me was I'm so focused on how do we save lives and, you know, we're rising to the occasion, that I don't think I was processing my own trauma. And I had to move across the country and start a new fellowship in June. And I think when I arrived somewhere where I didn't have this community who had also experienced these things with me, I don't think I tried hard enough to communicate to them that I really had experienced significant trauma. And, you know, both I probably hadn't quite processed that that was the case for me, but I also, to the extent that I was aware, I didn't really, you know, you're starting a new job, you want to make a good impression. And, you know, in retrospect, I really should have said, like, I don't know that you guys understand how challenging it is for me to come somewhere where no one really gets it, you know, and people, you know, I don't want to minimize like the trauma, for example, that veterans experience, because I never thought my own personal safety was, so I don't want to minimize that, but I do think I had this sort of realization like, wow, it's so hard to enter into a community where people don't have any awareness of what you've experienced. And I think that was the main thing that was really challenging for me.
In a similar but different, or I guess surprising way, in psychiatry, because all of us got dispersed to many different clinical services, a lot of the mechanisms in which we had to process our experiences, such as our process group, didn't, that we, you normally would have weekly with your co-residents, stopped, and a lot of our lectures stopped. And looking back, I think it would have been, I would keep that going, whether that meant it would had to be later on in the night after we got back. I think that would have been really helpful, because when we did get back to our service, a lot of my co-residents, we would sit down, and it took us a while for us to realize we had all been traumatized by what we experienced, and we hadn't talked about it with many other people. And that when we did, we felt better about it. But that delay, I think, was difficult, and makes even talking about it now with other people that don't understand really difficult.
I would say on the flip side, you know, starting as an ICU fellow, I think people are like, what's the big deal? You're an ICU fellow, you know, like, isn't this what you do? And I think there isn't that much appreciation for what, how we experienced was so unique and so terrifying, and kind of the specific things that we witnessed, both in terms of just really horrible, sad situations, families not being able to be with their loved ones who were dying, kind of care that the standard of care that was provided during this time was very different from what we were used to, and sort of having to bear witness to that and participate in it, I think really wore on us as doctors. And so it wasn't the same, but I don't know if other intensivists necessarily appreciate that.
I think both of you guys speak very movingly to what you've been through over the past year or so, and how you've changed. I'm sure there are many things that you'd like to forget, but I wonder if looking back, there are things you want to remember and sort of take with you from your experiences.
I remember there, for most of the patients that I saw and took care of, I would speak to their families twice a day, one kind of in midday after rounds and once in the evening to give them an update. And there was this one family who each time would tell me something about their loved one that I was taking care of. And it was such a beautiful experience that now, looking back, I know so much about this person that I cared for, and ultimately was there with their family member when they passed. And I think that's going to be an important part of when I'm taking care of patients, just thinking about who they are. I find that now I really pay attention more to the family members about who is this person, what is their lived experience, and just taking that that humanity with me, because I think that was such an important part of the care that we were giving, and it really influenced how I take care of patients now. And I don't want to forget that aspect.
I think the main thing that was the most meaningful for me about the experience was seeing how much people in my own department rose to the occasion. So there were a lot of challenges with staffing actually specialties other than doctors. So there was much more than doctors, a huge shortage of nurses, respiratory therapists, technicians, things like that. And so we as doctors were sort of watching really the sequela of, inadequate nursing and respiratory therapy care. Not, the ones who were there were doing their best, but there really were not enough of them. And so my department said, okay, all these people are getting respiratory complications. For example, a patient coded, we didn't know what happened. Someone pulled out the breathing tube and it was caked shut with respiratory secretions. And this was because there weren't enough respiratory therapists to go around and suction everyone's endotracheal tubes. So they redeployed a lot of the anesthesia residents as respiratory therapists. So we would show up for our 12-hour shift and I would go to all, 40 patients or whatever that I was assigned, and I would do little lavage and check their ventilator. And we had oral care specialists. So, even the chair of my department was walking from room to room, brushing patients' teeth. I mean, it was pretty amazing the ways in which people rose to the challenge. And especially people that had their own risks associated with filling these jobs. For me, I'm young and healthy and was only exposing my husband, who's also young and healthy, but a lot of these people were middle-aged or older, had young children, and they showed up too. And I think it was really, really amazing for me to see that.
What message might you both want to leave your colleagues who are listening today?
I think there is this approach sometimes in medicine that whatever you're experiencing, you kind of have to deal with, put that aside and kind of deal with your work and then later process it. And that our the most important part of our jobs is caring for the patients and providing really great care. And it was so clear to me in this process how important it was not only to take care of myself, but to also look around me and look at the providers, other providers that were around me, and think about, are they, can I support them and provide care to them? And I found that one of the best experiences of being in the ICU that I was in was that a lot of the other providers, the nurses, the respiratory therapists, the other physicians that had been redeployed would come in and say, you look like you need something to eat. Why don't you go take a break? Or I brought some bottles of water. I brought these resources, food. And we really took care of each other. And I think that if it wasn't for that, I don't know how I would have kind of continued in that space. And with that, the amount of work, and it was really such an important aspect of the care that we provided. And it just made, it made it so clear that it, how important it is for me to kind of check in on the people around me, particularly when we're taking care of other patients, because it's this experience just really highlighted how taxing it can be, and how it can really change your view of your job. Like when all of the pressure is there, it's really important to think about how we can help support each other during those times.
I agree. And I would also add, I think doctors in particular are a little bit prone to bias in the sense that we think we know what other people's experiences are like because we have medical or psychiatric knowledge. And, you know, I was sort of shocked by how much I found out later about other things that people had experienced, or, you know, they had family members be ill, or kind of personal things that they were experiencing. And I agree. I think it's so important to actually ask the question, you know, how are you doing? And is there anything else that might not be apparent? I also just want to share, I think for me, the moment that I realized maybe I wasn't okay, because when you're in it, you're like you said, you know, you're in survival mode, and just because you're holding it together and you're continuing to be able to do your work doesn't mean that you're okay. And for me, it was actually, I watched the video of George Floyd's murder, and intellectually I knew it was beyond horrific, a horrible display of racism. And I watched it and I had like no emotional reaction to it. And I was like, this is like, wow, I'm really messed up. I'm so numb to an emotion that I know I should be feeling so profoundly because of what I've experienced. And, you know, watching countless other people suffocate, sometimes because of my own doing. I think that was a moment that was like a wake-up call for me, like, wow, I really am not as okay as I think I am.
You know, both of you, I just want to express from both Jen and I our gratitude first and foremost for how you all just have stood in the gap for people. You know, you could have never anticipated this. But then on top of that, you show up here today and have the courage to share both of your stories and some of your experiences. And I really want to honor that vulnerability and your willingness to do so, because the reality is that there is somebody else that's hearing what you guys are sharing and is saying, like, that's how I feel, you know? And you're speaking your truth, and you're speaking about something that I think is really difficult for people to talk about who've experienced what you've experienced. So first and foremost, I want us to honor you guys for doing that. In addition to all the service that you provided during that time, my hope for you all is that in this sort of changing season and time, that there are opportunities for some respite and refuge, and for you all to be able to get the kind of care and support that you need and deserve. And for us to be able to learn from some of what you're sharing and telling, so that there is a way potentially to do better should something like this ever happen again, or for places in this world where the fight and the surges are still happening, in places that trainees are located still. Really want to express how grateful we are to both of you.
Thank you. And thanks so much for listening to our stories.
Thank you for giving us the space, and I would say encouraging me to kind of take a moment to think about my experiences a year plus later and try and kind of consolidate it at this point in time.
For those of you listening with us, who you yourself might be navigating a myriad of, you know, stressful, overwhelming, or intense emotions related to your experiences caring for patients during COVID-19, and some of the challenges that these two incredible young docs have discussed. We want to make sure that we mention a few resources of places where you can reach out. One is the SAMHSA National Hotline, where free and confidential referral and information services are provided. The number is 1-800-662-HELP. Again, that's 1-800-662-HELP. There's also a physician support line available. It's free and confidential, and no appointment is necessary. It's available 7 days a week from 8 a.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. The number there is 1-888-409-0141.